This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The race to succeed British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is a heated one. One of the front runners is believed to be the richest member of Parliament.
He is always going to be vulnerable to the sense that he just cannot relate to people who do not know how they're going to pay their energy bill.
I'm Marco Werman. Also, we wrap up our series looking at how wars end. Today, the delicate negotiations to end the Bosnian War in 1995.
This is all about trade-offs and accepting less than perfect outcomes as a function of how much cost and pain and suffering one is willing to bear or inflict.
Plus, women skateboarders in Bolivia come up with their own indigenous skater style, and soon-to-retire Serena Williams' global legacy away from center court. All coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has less than a month to go at 10 Downing Street, and right now two Conservative Party candidates are slugging it out to take his post. As for the public, many Brits seem squarely focused on the nation's sky-high energy bills and galloping inflation. Our Europe correspondent Orla Barry kicks us off today.
The contest to replace Boris Johnson is down to two contenders, Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss. Sunak is the former finance minister, Truss the current foreign secretary. But it's a past prime minister that's looming large over this leadership campaign.
I have only one thing to say. You turn if you want to. The ladies not for turning.
Margaret Thatcher, revered by so many on the right and hated by voters on the left. Liz Truss says Thatcher was the greatest British prime minister of all time.
She turned our country around. You know, she was a tremendous leader, a really world-changing leader.
Rishi Sunak has said pretty much the same thing. Liz Truss has even been accused of copying her fashion sense.
It's almost turning into theatre politics that Liz Truss is reverting back, if not to Thatcher, then to some Thatcher-esque figure.
That's Matthew Flinders, a politics professor at the University of Sheffield. He says channeling Thatcher probably appeals to older Conservative Party voters. And right now, the two candidates are focused on a small group. Just around 150,000 members of the Conservative Party get to decide who will be the next British Prime Minister.
And they are a very distinctive constituency of voters. You know, they're predominantly white, predominantly older.
And predominantly male. They're also thought to be wealthier than the average voter. The big issue concerning most people in Britain today is not who the next Prime Minister will be, but how this leader will deal with soaring energy bills. Some business owners have already seen costs go through the roof. Welsh pub owner Lucy Midgley's monthly electricity bill has jumped from around $700 to more than $5,000. She told local television this week she's taking drastic action.
No lights on. Actually asking our locals last night, did they mind sitting in darkness to enjoy their pint just to try and help us out in the short term?
Liz Truss's solution? Cut taxes. It's a popular idea with a lot of voters, but Rishi Sunak says Truss is just not facing up to reality.
The lights on the economy are flashing red, and the root cause is inflation. Now, I'm worried that Liz Truss's plans will make the situation worse.
But some voters may find it hard to take advice from a man believed to be the richest lawmaker in Parliament. Sunak is married to the daughter of one of India's wealthiest tycoons.
I think he is always going to be vulnerable to the sense that he just cannot relate to people who do not know how they're going to pay their energy bill.
Jill Rotter is a senior fellow with a think tank called the Institute of Government. And she points out that Sunak is also relatively new to politics. He only became an MP in 2015.
And I think you could say that Rishi Sunak's inexperience is also showing through. And Liz Truss just seems to understand the Conservative Party better and be prepared to say what it takes to get the Conservative Party on side.
In 2016, Liz Truss campaigned against Britain leaving the European Union. Now she's an ardent Brexiteer. One British news anchor recently asked her what she really stands for.
You were a Remainer, and now you're not. You supported Brits to fight in Ukraine, then you didn't. You wanted to abolish the monarchy, and now you don't. You wanted to arm Taiwan, and now I'm not sure if you're saying whether you do or not. Will the real Liz Truss please stand up?
Truss has been loyal to Boris Johnson, as many of their party colleagues pushed for him to go. Sunak was one of the first to walk out of government, eventually forcing the Prime Minister to call it quits. Voters often ask Sunak about his contentious past with Boris Johnson.
He is a man who made you as a senior politician. Many people, unfortunately, see that you've stabbed him in the back. And some people don't want to see that in number 10.
Liz Truss's loyalty to Johnson could play well with Conservative voters. Many of them are still big fans of the Prime Minister's. But politics professor Matthew Flinders says Johnson is not likely to go quietly.
I would want to get the keys off Boris very soon. Boris Johnson is never someone to retire, dare I say, gracefully or quietly.
Johnson's last day in office is September 4th. The next day, Britain is supposed to have a new leader. Right now, Liz Truss is ahead of Rishi Sunak in the polls. But a lot can happen during these days of high political drama. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
Across Brazil yesterday, people in nearly 50 cities rallied in defense of democracy. The country is holding presidential elections in October, and there are growing fears that if President Jair Bolsonaro loses, he may attempt an insurrection, a January 6 moment, to hang on to power. Michael Fox has more.
Dictatorship, never again. That was the hashtag and the theme of the protests. Large banners with that phrase hung in a courtyard at the University of Sao Paulo, where thousands turned out to hear the reading of a manifesto in defense of democracy that has captured the country's attention. More than a million Brazilians have signed on from across the political spectrum, including former presidents, ex-Supreme Court justices, bankers, and artists. In Sao Paulo, a classical guitarist accompanied lawyer and former politician Flavio Flores da Cunha as he read part of the letter to the crowd.
Ao invés de uma festa cívica, estamos passando por um momento de imenso.
Instead of a civic party, he read, we are facing a moment of immense danger to the democratic norms, risks to the country's democratic institutions, and insinuations of contempt for the results of the elections. The events yesterday were not your typical protests. Though they come as the presidential election is heating up, they were not a campaign rally by Bolsonaro's opponents. Many in the crowd wore suits and ties, lawyers, teachers, businessmen. Rio Grande do Sul Federal University sociologist Marcelo Kunrath says the widespread support for the Democracy Manifesto is something that Brazil hasn't seen in years.
Então, essa mobilização que conseguiu aí envolver.
This was really important, he says. It was even able to involve key business sectors, including the Sao Paulo Federation of Industries, which is a sign of the unity in defense of democracy that goes far beyond the political left. The timing of the rallies yesterday was significant. They were inspired by a similar letter that was read during protests on August 11, 1977, which denounced the military dictatorship that ruled Brazil at the time and demanded the rule of law. President Bolsonaro has ridiculed the movement demanding respect for democracy. They're trying to push me to the side, saying that I'm preparing a coup, he said. What coup? Demanding electoral transparency? Brazil's electronic voting system is world-renowned for being fast, efficient, and secure. But Bolsonaro has attacked it for years, denouncing supposed fraud without evidence. He's called for paper ballots and recently proposed that the military be tasked with filming Brazilians inside voting booths in order to ensure transparency. Sociologist Marcelo Kunrath says the mobilizations this week may indicate that there is a significant force of society with the capacity to block coup attempts, which he says are surely being discussed by Bolsonaro and his allies in the case of an electoral defeat. Bolsonaro has an approval rating of 40%, and he still has widespread appeal from evangelicals and far-right supporters. But former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva remains 7 points ahead of him in the latest polls. The electoral campaigns officially begin next week, Bolsonaro has called for his supporters to hit the streets en masse on September 7th for huge rallies coinciding with commemorations for the country's bicentennial independence. For The World, I'm Michael Fox.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is wrapping up his Africa trip this week. He made stops in South Africa and the Democratic Republic of the Congo, also Rwanda, where he spoke about human rights.
We believe people in every country should be able to express their views without fear of intimidation, imprisonment, violence, or any other forms of repression.
Blinken also introduced the Biden White House's new strategy for Africa. It includes assistance with greater security, economic recovery after the pandemic, and adapting to climate change. To reflect on what Blinken's visit really could mean, I'm joined by Zeynep Usman. She directs the Africa program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. What is the biggest takeaway you see with Blinken's visit and the new strategies he laid out?
I would say that the biggest takeaway from the visit is that the fact that the visit is happening now, which is less than a year from a prior visit that Blinken made to the African continent in November 2021. We know that under the Trump administration, the Secretary of State made just a few visits to the African continent. So it's an indication that maybe the Biden administration wants to do things differently.
So alongside Blinken in Pretoria this week was South Africa's Minister for International Relations, Naledi Pandor. She said some European nations have put pressure on her and other African leaders to choose sides over the Russia-Ukraine conflict.
One thing I definitely dislike is being told either you choose this or else. I definitely will not be bullied in that way.
Zeynep, if you look at how African nations voted on removing Russia from the UN's Human Rights Council in April, for example, that seems to be a pretty good gauge of how many do not want to be dragged into the war debate. The majority abstained or were not present for that vote. Now, South Africa's Naledi Pandor, whom we just heard from, says she has not received pressure from Blinken on this. Still, what kind of pressure are African leaders facing to choose sides?
I would say that the war in Ukraine, in a way, is the backdrop to the visit by Blinken. The Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, was also on the continent. He was in Ethiopia, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and a few other countries just a few days before Blinken's own arrival. I think in particular for Europe, given that this is a war that is happening at its own doorstep, there are a lot of countries that have been quite taken aback by the fact that African countries have just not naturally taking their own side in the conflict.
We should recall China is also very involved in development projects in Africa. How aggressively is the U.S.-China contest playing out in Africa and for Africans?
A lot of African countries have made it very clear that they do not want to be forced to choose sides between the U.S. and China. They do not want to be dragged into a new Cold War. Obviously, America is a major partner for a lot of African countries on specific areas, especially around democracy, around governance, and around security. China is a major economic partner for African countries, and a lot of Chinese companies are engaged in infrastructure construction. You know, you can see the dilemma for African countries. They do not want to be forced to choose sides on this front, but this competition between the U.S. and China is proceeding nevertheless.
I mean, indeed, talk is one thing, but action is another. Were there specific parts of the White House's new Africa strategy that were kind of outlined this week that you're going to be watching closely to see exactly what the follow-up is from Washington?
Yes, the climate part on supporting a just energy transition in African countries, investing in renewable energy, energy efficiency. Climate change is a defining issue for African countries right now. The U.S. government has an opportunity to start acting very quickly. You know, we have the UN Climate Summit coming up in Egypt in November. So there's an opportunity there to rally also European allies to ensure that they support a just transition. And I think that's a very low-hanging fruit.
Zeynep Usman is director of the Africa program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Thank you very much for being with us and unpacking all this.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to The World.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. In Bolivia, a collective of female skateboarders has caught the attention of news media. That's partly because of the clothes they wear, but it's not just about skater style, as The World's Tibisay Isaiah tells us. These indigenous women are trying to change stereotypes rooted in Bolivian society.
When you think of a skater, you probably imagine someone wearing baggy jeans, a loose t-shirt, and maybe a baseball cap. Well, not for this collective of all-female indigenous skateboarders in Bolivia. Instead, they're dressed in a colorful and layered skirt as they practice their kickflips. The skirts are called polleras, and they are traditionally worn by indigenous women in the high mountains of Bolivia. This skirt goes back to the 16th century when Spanish colonizers would impose local women to wear it. Over time, the pollera ended up being a symbol of the Quechua and Aymara ethnic groups in the Andean region of South America, but it's also an object of discrimination.
Yo en lo personal, yo jamás pensé haberme vestido de cholita.
I never would have imagined myself wearing the traditional clothes of a cholita, says Daisy Takuri. Cholita is the word used in Bolivia to refer to indigenous women. Takuri is one of the 9 women with a collective of skateboarders called Imija Skate. Imija means girl in Quechua. They're all in their 20s and come from indigenous backgrounds.
Y en mi familia no me vistió mi mamá jamás, no.
My family never encouraged me to look like a cholita, she says.
Porque ella decía de que no, vivimos en la ciudad y en la ciudad son...
My mother would say, señorita, women in the city need to wear pants.
Sí, ha habido mucha discriminación, digamos, con la pollera.
Takuri says she and other women in her family have experienced discrimination just for wearing that traditional skirt. Fernando Molina, author of the book Racism in Bolivia, says up until recently, cholitas were second-class citizens. They were socially excluded, denied access to higher education and common spaces or public transportation.
Las personas que hacen el trabajo doméstico, niñeras, cocineras.
Molina says many indigenous women were stuck cleaning houses, cooking or washing clothes. Indigenous peoples are now recognized in Bolivia's constitution. They have greater political power, too. But Molina says the problem of discrimination persists.
Ahora este proyecto no ha funcionado del todo bien porque
he says that didn't work so well because there was a lot of reaction against the empowerment of indigenous peoples, and white people remain the dominant class in Bolivia.
Se necesita políticas públicas, discriminación positiva.
Bolivia needs better policies, reparations, and affirmative action to change that, Molina says. It's not only about laws or the constitution, it's how we put them into practice. He says initiatives like the skateboarding collective can help change perceptions. That's happening in the city of Cochabamba, where Daisy Takuri helped create a new skateboarding school.
Incluso tenemos escuelita de skateboarding.
She says more people, especially women, are skateboarding now, and the city is offering more public spaces for skating. And it's not unusual to see women on skateboards wearing polleras, Takuri says. Just come, have fun, and be yourself, she says. It makes us feel empowered. The skateboarding collective appears in a new documentary that comes out in a few weeks. It shows the women traveling across Bolivia, teaching skateboarding to young kids, and of course, wearing polleras. For The World, I am Tibisay Sea.
The tennis world learned this week that soon it'll be losing one of its all-time greats. Serena Williams is hanging up her racket. She dominated women's tennis for 2 decades. As The World's Bianca Hillier reports, Williams' legacy goes well beyond her achievements on center court.
A tennis match can go from dead quiet to thunderous applause in the blink of an eye.
And Serena smashes Stevie's record. It's number 23.
Williams exhilarated crowds countless times over her 27-year career and 23 Grand Slam titles. From Australia to France to London.
It's Serena Williams again.
Her dedication to the game has been strong from the beginning. In 2002, she spoke with NBC after grabbing the world number one spot for the first time.
My dad always said, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" And I said, "I want to be the best." And I just always have, you know, dreamed of being that.
Williams went on to spend 319 weeks in that top spot. Along the way, she ignited dreams in countless young athletes around the world. Sports journalist Natasha Henry says her presence has been especially influential in Black communities.
For a lot of people, Serena and Venus Williams are the first Black women in tennis.
Henry grew up in the UK and remembers watching Williams and her older sister Venus on TV.
I always remember them with the beads in their hair. You know, they always had different hair colors, the way their hair was styled in the plaits. It was just very comforting to me, I suppose. It just made me feel my culture.
Seeing Williams excel not only empowered people to be themselves, but it also inspired kids to get into tennis, like Coco Gauff, who's now ranked 11th in the world. She said at a press conference this week that Serena Williams is the reason she got into the sport.
You know, tennis being predominantly white sport, it definitely helped a lot because I saw somebody look like me dominating the game and it made me believe that I could dominate too.
Williams has faced anti-Black racism throughout her career. In 2018, an Australian cartoon depicted her as an irate, oversized player acting violently on the court. And at a match back in 2001, the crowd booed the entire Williams family as they walked out.
An American crowd booing an American family. And you have to say that it does smack of a little bit of racism.
After winning the match, Williams said the racist reception forced her to push her focus from the physical part of the game to the mental part.
I didn't even play well, so I just was able to perform mentally. And it was a little tough, but, you know, if you're a champion, you should be able to get through it.
Natasha Henry says there's beauty in how Williams handled situations like this.
She always called it out straight away. You know, if there was an incident during a match from the fans in that press conference after, she would talk about it. Whether or not people understood it at the time, that was a lesson for all of us.
Williams has also done good with her $94 million in prize money. She has her own venture capital firm and has invested in a number of tech and finance companies in Africa. She's also invested in Andela, a company that trains software developers across the continent. Natasha Henry says it's clear that Williams' story motivates people far outside the tennis world.
You know, if you're from a working class industry and you maybe get a job as a banker, you can relate to what Serena Williams went through. If someone makes us believe that we can finish so much higher than we ever dreamt, then how amazing is that?
Williams hasn't specifically said when she'll step off the court for good. But when she does, Henry is confident people across the globe will still be watching her. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. Still ahead on The World, we go to Spain to learn about inclusive dance. Professionals on stage working with people on crutches and in wheelchairs. It is inclusive and it is not amateur hour.
Creo que pertenezco a una corriente artística.
I feel part of a new artistic movement, says this choreographer. The competitions and TV time suggest it is a movement. That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. We now wrap up our week-long series looking at how wars end. As we've heard this week, wars don't typically end neatly, tied up with a bow. And remember that our series was first reported in 2008 by The World's Jeb Sharp, but the historical lessons remain as relevant and important as ever. Today, we turn our focus to the end of the Bosnian War in 1995. Here's Jeb.
The Bosnian War ended with a peace agreement at Dayton, Ohio. The negotiations there presented an extraordinary image. U.S. diplomats, including Secretary of State Warren Christopher, welcoming Serbian leader Slobodan Milosevic as a statesman, even though they considered him a war criminal. When the deal was struck, it was President Bill Clinton who announced it.
About an hour ago, I spoke with Secretary Christopher in Dayton, Ohio.
He informed me that the presidents of Bosnia, Croatia, and Serbia have reached a peace agreement to end the war in Bosnia.
It was a huge turnaround. Just a few months before, the Clinton administration had been mired in indecision over Bosnia. Bill Clinton had campaigned for president on promises of stronger action, but when he came into office, he did nothing. But the pressure was building steadily. The evidence of atrocities was irrefutable. European policy was a failure. UN initiatives were ineffective. Key State Department officials had resigned in protest at American inaction.
At one point, the National Security Advisor, Tony Lake, went in to see the president, President Clinton, and said, "There's a cancer on the presidency."
Ivo Dalder is the author of Getting to Dayton, The Making of America's Bosnia Policy.
Saying that Bosnia was this cancer, that if we didn't find a way to resolve Bosnia, this would be an issue in the 1996 election.
That argument worked on President Clinton. His aides began devising a new strategy. The game plan was to split Bosnia into two entities, but keep it as a single country. The Muslims and Croats would get one half, and the Serbs would get the other. NATO would supervise a peace agreement, and if necessary, the United States would use force to change the dynamic.
The thought was that if the Serbs said no, that we would arm and train, and indeed strike from the air for a period of a year, to change the internal balance of power within Bosnia and to change the balance of power on the ground.
As the policy was shaping up, the worst massacre of the war unfolded. The Bosnian Serbs overran the UN safe area of Srebrenica. The so-called safe areas turned out to be anything but. Small contingents of lightly armed peacekeepers were no match for Bosnian Serb forces intent on ethnic cleansing. In Srebrenica, thousands of people took refuge in a UN compound, only to be handed over to the Serbs. The outside world pieced together what had happened from terrified survivors. They took all the wounded to one side, she said. And then a Serb soldier said, "I know you." And he took me away to a house and held a gun to my head while another soldier raped me. The men and boys of Srebrenica were slaughtered. Aerial photographs taken in the days afterwards showed what looked like freshly dug mass graves. Madeleine Albright was U.S. ambassador to the United Nations at the time. She took those photographs to the Security Council.
There is a compelling case that there were wide-scale atrocities committed in the area against defenseless civilians away from the battlefield area.
Some 7,000 Bosnian Muslims were killed at Srebrenica. There was no turning back now. Among themselves, administration officials began using the word genocide. The United States began to implement its endgame strategy. It was orchestrated by the hard-charging diplomat Richard Holbrooke.
The United States finally led a NATO coalition into bombing the Bosnian Serbs, and that really got their attention. And simultaneously, the president launched into the field a negotiating team, which he asked me to lead.
Holbrooke spent the next few weeks crisscrossing the Balkans, talking to all the leaders. His negotiating was helped by an unexpected development.
A remarkable thing happened, which was more coincidence than concept, but it really affected the negotiations. The Croatians launched an offensive in western Bosnia, which was quite successful in pushing the Bosnian Serbs back. So facts on the ground were changing the equation and strengthening the hand for the negotiation.
There was one more helpful development that strengthened the U.S. hand. Serbian leader Slobodan Milosevic was coming to the conclusion that he needed to sue for peace, that he needed the sanctions against his country lifted for his own survival. With Milosevic on board, Holbrooke secured a ceasefire and persuaded Balkan leaders to fly to Dayton for talks.
The world's eyes will be on Dayton and on Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. We have a very tough job ahead of us. We are not here to promise you success, but only our best efforts.
Then Holbrooke got to work. He and his aides shuttled among the three sides. He spent days huddled in a high-tech map room trying to sort out the border between Bosnia's new entities.
We had to draw that line, and the line was unbelievably difficult to draw. We had to write a constitution. We had to get agreements among the allies and among NATO about what our responsibilities would be. We had to create a governmental structure. Every bit of it was difficult.
But Holbrook and his team kept at it, over meals, on windy walks, in late-night corridors. Just before Thanksgiving, Holbrook got his deal.
The agreements and territorial arrangements, initialed today, are a huge step forward, the biggest by far since the war began. But ahead lies an equally daunting task, implementation.
He was right. Implementing the agreement with its cumbersome directives would be a tough challenge. Bosnian President Alija Izetbegovic made it clear when he signed the document that he didn't think it was a just peace. Not only did it grant the Serbs territory that they had won through ethnic cleansing, it locked down ethnic divisions by creating a constitution based explicitly on ethnic identity. Over the years, it's caused great bitterness and governmental gridlock. That feeling of insecurity is pervasive in Bosnia, and that doesn't surprise people who study the ends of wars. Stephen Biddle of the Council on Foreign Relations says agreements like the Dayton Accords are inherently unstable.
In this kind of situation where everybody's making a grudging, partial, negotiated settlement in which they gave up a lot, it's very easy to imagine situations in which spoiler violence or miscalculation or a mistake reignites the violence and you end up right back where you were before.
Which is why, Biddle says, the presence of outside peacekeepers has been the key to the success of the settlement in Bosnia. As for whether Bosnia was a just peace, Biddle points out that stability is not the same as justice.
Part of the reason that you get war and part of the reason that the just war tradition in Christian theology is accepting of the idea of war is that there's a value conflict between justice and peace.
You could argue that justice in Bosnia would have meant punishing the Serbs for their ethnic cleansing. Instead, they were rewarded for it with half the territory in the country. But the Americans' immediate goal was not justice. It was stopping the bloodshed. It was stability.
Stability is a privileging of peace over justice. War, in many cases, is a privileging of justice over peace. This is all about trade-offs and accepting less than perfect outcomes as a function of how much cost and pain and suffering one is willing to bear or inflict.
Still, the question of justice hangs heavy over the settlement in Bosnia. Peter Galbraith was the U.S. ambassador to Croatia at the time. He agreed with the U.S. decision to condone a joint Croat-Muslim offensive against the Serbs in western Bosnia in the last weeks of the war, but he also agreed with the decision to stop it before it defeated the Serbs. Now he wonders if it wouldn't have been better to let the offensive roll on.
Even to this day, I don't know if we did the right thing or not. At the time, it seemed to make sense.
U.S. officials wanted the Serbs to lose more territory, but they didn't want a bloodbath. Nor did they want any more large refugee flows, just as the war was winding down.
But the other side of the coin is that the Bosnian Serbs were fascists, genocidal fascists. And it might have been a better end to the war for them to be decisively defeated rather than continuing in power and continuing with this insane nationalism of theirs.
Ultimately, though, even as he wrestles with his doubts, Galbraith hangs on to Bosnia as a success story.
The United States focused on an achievable mission, which was ending the war. We did not try to remake Bosnia. We would love to have remade Bosnia, but that wasn't achievable, or at least not in the short term. What was achievable was to end the war. And the second point I would make is we were prepared to negotiate with evil men.
That's still a sore point in the region. Many remember the image of Richard Holbrooke dining with Slobodan Milosevic during the Bosnian War, and again in the lead-up to the war in Kosovo. Svetlana Broz is an author and physician in Sarajevo.
The whole international community, including Mr. Holbrooke, accepted Milosevic as the negotiator, as somebody who is the peacemaker, which was really absolutely cynical. And I cannot understand this approach as a citizen who was the, I would say, as millions of citizens of Serbia, Croatia, Bosnia and Herzegovina, Kosovo, Montenegro, victims of his politics.
And Broz says it left a confused ending, with nobody really laying out who was right and who was wrong. Ivo Dalder was a national security official at the time. He agrees Bosnia is still mired in a messy peace, but back then there was little choice. The war had to be ended somehow.
This was the most bloody conflict in Europe since 1945. We had concentration camps in Europe. We had massacres on a mass scale, something we hadn't seen since 1945. This was paralyzing Europe. It was paralyzing NATO. It was paralyzing American foreign policy to a large extent. And we ended that conflict. We stopped the killing. That's an extraordinary achievement, even if we haven't succeeded in making Bosnia the new nirvana on earth.
Dalder takes a lesson from Bosnia. It's a lot easier to end violence than it is to build a peace. And maybe you shouldn't always try to do both. Dalder says he'd like to see less hubris about changing societies and more ambition about stopping violence.
Our moral obligation, as well as our strategic obligation, should first and foremost be to stop these kinds of conflicts and then worry later about how do you make sure that the peace to follow is as good as the end of the conflict. In many instances, these are issues that parties and people on the ground will have to decide. It's really difficult for us to do so. We see it in Afghanistan. We see it in Iraq. Our ability to build peaceful, stable societies is, I think, less than our ability to stop a war.
But even our ability to stop a war is limited. Much has changed since the humanitarian interventions of the 1990s. After 9/11 and Afghanistan and Iraq and our inaction in Darfur, we still have much to learn about how wars end and peace takes root. For the World, I'm Jeb Sharp.
So many things to pick up on there since Jeb's report first aired in 2008. The U.S. military involvement in Iraq and Afghanistan, of course, is now over. Some of the players we heard from, like Ambassadors Madeleine Albright and Richard Holbrooke, are no longer alive. Others have moved on to different positions and jobs. To bring this idea of how wars end up to the present, we turn to Barbara F. Walter, a professor at UC San Diego and the author of How Civil Wars Start. Also poignant, Barbara, to hear Ivo Dalder there refer to the Bosnia conflict as the most bloody war on the European continent since 1945. 100,000 dead. Now there's Ukraine, and it remains to be seen how much worse it could get. As far as Bosnia goes today, a place you focused on, once again, there's tension. Can I get a brief update from you on what's happening right now in Bosnia?
One of the things that we know about civil wars is that they tend to repeat themselves. And of course, we know that that's the case in the former Yugoslavia and in Bosnia. And so what you're seeing today in Bosnia is what you have seen historically across the globe, where you have groups that had once been dominant. They suffered a political loss, and they eventually regroup and try to regain it. And so that's what you're seeing happening in Bosnia today.
So your book, How Civil Wars Start, and your research have primarily focused on smaller conflicts, especially civil wars, and how they start. I gather when you begin to count, there have been a lot of them around the globe since World War II. Maybe you can name a few that we might have forgotten about.
There's been over 200 of them since 1946. This would include wars in, it would be the war in Ukraine that started in 2014. It would be wars in Mozambique, Angola, Cambodia, Nicaragua, El Salvador, Guatemala.
As you look at the current global landscape, what are the tripwires to conflict that worry the most?
Well, we do know that we are living in an age of civil wars. Today, we now have more civil wars around the globe than we ever have in history. What's driving that? We don't exactly know. One of the reasons is perhaps the rise of the internet, in particular social media, and its ability to give demagogues and extremists access to large numbers of people. That's a place where they can easily spread their message, and so it has a radicalizing effect. The world is going through a period of large migrations, and this also has the effect of making people feel a little more insecure. One of the things that we know puts countries at risk of civil war is if they're democratizing or if their democracy is declining. It's partial democracies that tend to experience civil wars. And the 21st century was a period of rapid democratization around the world. And with that came the rise of civil war. And now we're entering a period of autocratization, where once healthy democracies are in decline, that's creating an increase in partial democracies around the world. And again, we would expect to see a rise of civil wars when that occurs.
So the U.S. is a deeply polarized country right now. Are the seeds planted in the U.S. that could start a civil war here? Or is that just too far-fetched, as some people believe?
So I don't think it's too far-fetched. The type of war that you see is really an insurgency. These are decentralized conflicts. They tend to be fought by multiple different fighting groups, and they actively try not to engage the military. Instead, they take war to civilians. Here in the United States, we've already seen a little bit of that, where synagogues are targeted, places where African Americans shop are targeted, opposition leaders are assassinated. And so that's the type of war that you are likely to see here in the United States.
So can the world ever get to a point where peace feels like the default, not war?
Steve Pinkner wrote this fabulous book called The Better Angels of Our Nature. The book was all about how violence, every form of violence, has declined around the world over the last hundreds of years. So it does appear as if human beings are learning.
We certainly appreciate the optimism. Barbara F. Walter is a professor at UC San Diego and the author of How Civil Wars Start and How to Stop Them. Thank you very much for joining us for this conversation.
Thank you for having me.
An emerging art form is moving people all across the globe. It's called inclusive dance. The name says it all. Dancers in wheelchairs, on crutches, or with no obvious challenges, they're all together on stage, professionals and amateurs. There are now even international competitions. Although, as we hear from Jerry Haddon in Albacete, Spain, inclusive dance purists say winning awards is not the point.
It's final dress rehearsal in Albacete's grand old theater. A 30-year-old woman, Cris Cabezuelo, sits under a spotlight, dancers at her feet. She hesitates. She's nervous. Then... I came to know this wheelchair when I was 5, she says. I don't like it, but it helps me to dance. Without it, and the help of my friends, I wouldn't be able to dance at all. Then the bespectacled Cabezuelo is swarmed by her onstage friends. A dozen fellow dancers slide around and over her, caressing her face, her shoulders. They help her to stand. Cabezuelo has Down syndrome. It's a touching scene, but this is just rehearsal, and choreographer Ramon Marcos still isn't satisfied.
De hecho, os voy a enseñar una foto para que veáis el pegote. Esto se ve.
I'm going to show you a photo of how clumped together you were in that last scene, he says. What a horror. Marcos has been directing inclusive dance for a dozen years. He's one of the pioneers. Marcos says he stumbled upon the form as he was finishing his studies, and it changed his life.
Sí, no, yo llamé a mi madre y se lo dije. Le dije, ¿pero esto qué es? O sea, claro, yo había estado desde los...
I called my mom and said, what is this? Imagine, he says. I've been dancing since I was 8, went to the conservatory, then university. I was studying to be a dance teacher, he says. But when I saw this inclusive dance, I realized I had no tools at all. I had no tools at all for really reaching people. Marcos has danced all over the world, but he says he faces the same prejudices his diverse dancers deal with daily, from within the art world. They say, oh, you're dancing with abnormal people, he says, because it's much easier, or you must have gotten injured. What they don't understand, he says, is that this is an entirely new language, like switching from English to Spanish, he says. I think I'm part of a new artistic movement, he says, that people will study years from now, like, say, Expressionism. For Marcos' dancers, today is all about bringing that new movement to life. I really like performing, says 34-year-old Tomás Calonje, bounding about the stage in a t-shirt and sweatpants. I'm a star, he says. I love being surrounded by colleagues. Calonje also has Down syndrome. His favorite part of this hour-long performance... They drag me by my feet, he explains. Then I climb up on a table behind a curtain, and it's disco time. Later that night, before a packed house, Calonje lets loose. Everybody up, he cries. Let's dance, everyone together. The audience obliges. Think Soul Train in a 19th century opera house. There are now inclusive dance companies all over the world, in Latin America, the U.S. In Russia, there's a yearly international competition. Performers say the art form has evolved enough to drop the inclusive name. Everyone's just a dancer. No labels needed. But tonight's show does close with a nod toward diversity and acceptance. Chris Cabezuelo, in her wheelchair, gets the giggles, then delivers her line. Without my friend, she says, I couldn't dance. And again, she's embraced by the dancers, her friends, and by the crowd. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Albacete, Spain.
Jerry's reporting this summer has also taken us to the French Alps, where a severe drought has turned a river known for great sailing into dry land, where floating docks are now resting on the sand. The photos of this altered landscape are dramatic. Take a look at our website, theworld.org. And be sure to join us this Monday as we mark the anniversary of the Taliban's takeover of Kabul. The group seized Afghanistan's capital after weeks of taking over smaller cities across the country. We'll be revisiting the dramatic events that unraveled 20 years of U.S. military presence in Afghanistan and hear how Afghans are dealing with the present and their future under Taliban rule. That's Monday here on The World. We leave you today with the spirit of collaboration between two extremely talented artists, people we've featured on the show before. Trumpeter Ibrahim Malouf and singer Angélique Kidjo. At times, a high energy partnership. This is a new recording of theirs called Queen of Sheba, where the French-Lebanese horn player and the Beninois singer create a sound that, in the best possible way, harkens back to 1970s fusion jazz. They're also pulling on Middle Eastern and West African idioms already in their pockets. That is our show on this Friday. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Keep up with us when we're not on the air at theworld.org. Have yourselves a relaxing weekend, and as always, be safe and stay strong. Thank you for listening.
From PRX.